The following program brought to you by Comprehensive Financial Consultants and CFCI, which is solely responsible for its content. Securities are offered through J.W. Cole Financial, member FINRA and SIPC. Investment advice offered through CFCI and J.W. Cole Advisors. J.W. Cole Financial, J.W. Cole Advisors, and CFCI are unaffiliated entities. The opinions expressed by the members of CFCI and their guests should not be construed as specific investment, legal, or tax advice. All economic and performance information is historical and not indicative of future results. Investing may involve the risk of loss of principal, and any tax advice on the show is not intended to be used by any persons for the purpose of avoiding U.S. federal or state tax. Penalties that may be imposed on such persons and each listener should seek advice from their tax advisor or legal counsel on topics that arise from the show. The representatives of CFCI and their guests are not providing legal or tax advice, and nothing should be construed as a solicitation to offer or buy securities. Now enjoy the show.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the big show, Your Money with David Hayes. If you miss any of the show on Thursday night, you can always catch it on Saturday morning at 9 a.m. over on WGCLradio.com, or be one of my many new subscribers to iTunes. You can go to iTunes and click on Your Money with David Hayes in the iStore, subscribe, and then each and every week when we post a new show, pow, you have notification. You can play it, enjoy it, and hopefully learn something as well. All right, we've got a lot to go over today. Rod Holloway is going to be in the house. We're going to be talking about investments. It is the investment show. And then later, a Nobel Prize in Economics was issued or given out on behavioral finance. So Doug Hughes will join us for a brief discussion on that. And then later on, Josh Norris, our Medicare specialist, will be coming on again to remind you about open enrollment period. And something cool that happened to Josh this week, you know, I get several interview requests with Forbes, CNBC, gosh, Rod, you're here with me. Many other online publications.
Yeah, but I was going to say many that we were unaware of, and once we become aware of them, find out, wow, they're really nice sites that have a lot of good quality information out there for the people that want to educate themselves on financial products.
Yeah, a lot of good stuff. So Josh is going to get, they asked for an interview regarding some Medicare stuff. I'm like, you know what, I'm not the guy. Josh is your guy. So Josh is scheduled to interview with Sarah O'Brien, which is a pretty common name from CNBC.com, tomorrow at 4 p.m. on Friday. So this will be Josh's first time getting national press. So it was kind of becoming old hat for us, I guess, at this point. Hey, before we get to all that, let's just do a little brief news of the week brought to you by the Monroe County Sports Hall of Fame, supported, of course, by Comprehensive Financial Consultants. To learn more about Monroe County Sports Hall of Fame, go to mcshof.com or just Google Monroe County Sports Hall of Fame, and it will pop right up. This past Monday, October 9th, marked the 10th anniversary of the S&P 500's highest point before the Great Recession. Of course, while the ensuing decade has provided quite a rocky road to the markets at times, the recovery is obviously undeniable. Even though last week we had a little hiccup on Friday, for the most part, 7 years of, I'm sorry, basically, what, almost 10 years of steady growth after the big crash in 2008. So let's see, that's actually, how many years is that, Rod?
The recovery began in March of 2009.
Yeah, so I'm sitting there getting my toes out.
Yeah, we didn't bring our calculators with us.
One of my good buddies, who's actually an engineer and a mathematician, says it's always hard for him to turn the corner. On, like, if it's a basketball game, the score is 57-64. He's like, okay, what is that?
Yeah.
You know, it's easy if it's like 50-57 at 7 points, but quickly, 57-63. What's the, okay? They're up 3-7. They're up 6. Okay, got it. But anyway, so we've had obviously domestic gains that have come despite some hiccups along the road. We've had 7 years of monthly growth. The September jobs report was the very first one that we've seen any contraction in jobs. We'll be talking about that more later, since 2010. Some say the decrease was due to the aftermath of the hurricanes, but despite the unexpected contraction, the unemployment rate did fall to the lowest level in 16 years. Average hourly earnings have increased, which is great, by almost 3%. So we're going to be talking, Rod, a lot about the third quarter, what happened, what it looked like, and then obviously more importantly, what do we expect that's going to happen in the fourth quarter. So we'll take a quick break. We got a lot to talk about, so we're going to start off with that. When we come back, this is Your Money with David Hayes. Welcome back, everyone. Your Money with David Hayes. It is the investment show, which means Hot Rod Holloway is in the house. Of course, Rod calls into Glass in the Morning on Mondays and Fridays. Rod, I'm always interested to listen on Mondays to see how much really happened between Friday and Monday. And unless it's a big, big news day on a Friday, not much has changed with your discussion from Friday morning to Monday morning.
No, normally, hopefully, we get to talk about positive things that happened with IU football or something along those lines on Monday, because you're
Break
right, with the markets
bit.
Closed, there's not a whole lot that goes on. You know, of course, jobs Friday, that's always
right.
big. That number comes out after I phone into Glass, so it's always good to come back and recap that on Monday. But, yeah, there's not a lot that goes on with the market on Saturdays and Sundays.
Speaking of that, last Friday was jobs Friday, and the market contracted again. First time since 2010, 33,000 jobs lost. They're kind of blaming this on the hurricanes, but I'm not real sure. I think it may just be simply the employers taking a break from hiring. I think we need about 145,000 jobs every month just to kind of keep up with population growth. Obviously a big surprise to most, but it didn't seem to derail the markets too much.
Yeah, no, I think most of the economists who dove into the numbers saw positive things within the number that wouldn't have been impacted by the hurricane, so made them feel comfortable that, yeah, the lion's share of that impact was hurricane. Now, that doesn't mean, as you had mentioned, if we need 140 jobs as far as the burn rate, we need at least 140 to stay where we at the previous month, you know, losing 30,000 jobs and, you know, I don't think that we truly had a loss of all those jobs non-hurricane related. The reality is we've been on such a strong jobs growth environment for so long now, it's going to have to slow down. I mean, we grew at a pace of 200,000 new jobs added per month, which, as you alluded to, if you eliminate that burn rate, that's adding about 60,000 brand new jobs a month mm-hmm. above and beyond that burn rate. That's strong. Now, we're starting to trend down to about 180, but the reality is when you've got unemployment down in the low 4%, and obviously that can be argued how accurate that is because you're not counting
sure.
the people who have given up and chose to no longer look, but they're coming back into that number and they are being counted because they're seeing their neighbors who couldn't find jobs forever find jobs suddenly. So they are coming back in, so you see that. But yeah, it's going to be hard to have big blowout jobs numbers when you've got unemployment in the mid to low 4%.
You know, you can almost always find good in something. I was thinking, can I even say this on the radio? But you know, if something happened and you said, boy, that just really stunk, you could always say, well, if I wouldn't have walked by that nasty trash can at that particular time of the day, then it wouldn't have stunk. So they can always find
sure.
good in these numbers. And I think when you're in a state of euphoria or optimism like we are right now in the markets, I just think that's the attitude you're going to continue to see.
Oh, yeah. You hear that a lot with retailers that come out and want to blame poor performance on the weather.
Or on
well,
Amazon.
Hey, guess what? The weather's always out there. You know, obviously, it doesn't rain every single day, but it is an issue that retailers have to deal with because it rains, it snows, it gets really hot, it gets windy, all of those things. So those really aren't good excuses as to why you didn't meet your numbers on a quarterly basis.
Yeah, why didn't I catch any fish last week at Boggs Lake? Well, I can make up all kinds of excuses of why I didn't and why I should have or why I will next time. And I think that's what economists and people that you know talk about this stuff do all the stinking time. All right, let's talk about the third quarter. I mean, if we had to pick one word to describe performance in the third quarter, it would be positive, obviously sustained market growth. And this is good because throughout the quarter, all four indices that we tend to track in our weekly update had solid showings, hit numbers of record highs. Both the Dow S&P marked their eighth straight quarter of gains. The NASDAQ wasn't far behind with its fifth positive quarter in a row. S&P 500 even had its least volatile quarter since September over 47 years ago. So volatility just simply not there. And we've continued to see global gains. Globally, European emerging markets posted their third straight quarter of impressive gains in September. Chinese manufacturing experiences fastest growth in 2012, which means that, you know, they export all that stuff. That means there's been a lot of demand. But really, when you think about our focus on it, you know, what drove the markets in the third quarter? A lot of things. Positive performance reflects solid corporate earnings. We had stronger oil prices. We had impressive core capital good orders. Again, people ordering stuff, that means that they're going to be selling it. Even though inflation still remains pretty darn low, at least below the Fed's target of 2%, at the end of the day, you know, the third quarter was quote, positive.
Yeah, most certainly was. Matter of fact, as you talked about all of the things going on positive, not only here but around the globe, Japan's stock market hit a 20-year high. Now, of course, their all-time high is like double what that 20-year ago high.
The all-time high is like 40,000, and they finally hit 22 again.
Yeah, but you know, that is a high for 20 years, so things are moving. You know, and I think that's one thing that we haven't talked a lot about. We have most certainly talked international, and we've talked about Europe and Asia and things going on in the emerging markets. I don't know that we've really talked about it in conjunction of the simultaneous growth that we've got going on globally, which that's a big reason that the U.S. stock market has held so steady and so strong. It's not just what's going on here. It's what's going on all across the globe. And even though we know our election and the Brexit was kind of anti-globalization, the reality is globalization is here. It's here to stay. And if things are doing very well around the globe, it picks up other areas. Not that we were struggling, but it is adding a little bit of fuel to our fire that we've been having.
You and I have had this discussion, and there's no science behind this. It's just us being in the business 25 years almost. You rarely see the emerging markets, the European markets, the Asian markets, the South Central Asian markets doing well if the U.S. isn't doing well. You can sometimes see, and many times have seen even recently, the U.S. market do well and the others lag. So I believe that there's a lesson to be learned there. I don't know exactly what it is, but I will say this, folks, that a lot of you out there are hearing, okay, S&P hit new high, the S&P is this, the Dow's that, and you say, wow, it's, you know what, up 16% you know, since the first of the year, or 22% on the NASDAQ. I don't know one person that's of the age that actually has a decent amount of money that 100% of their money is in the market. And if you look at the bond markets have been relatively flat. So if you have a 50-50 mix of stocks and bonds, let's say in your 401k plan, maybe you're in the Lifestyle 2020 fund or 2025, and half your money made nothing and half of it did what the market did at 15 or 16%, you just basically take the average and you're going to be up about 6 or 7% in a blended portfolio. I have been telling that to so many people who come in and say, well, I'm not making as much money in my 401k or whatever as what I think I should. It's because of the allocation. Does that mean you should run out and put more money into stocks? Absolutely not. I think the allocation is based on a lot of different reasons, your risk tolerance, your time horizon, you know, what kind of return you need to get to where you want to go. But, Rod, I can tell you that because they only talk about that on the news, that's what's on people's minds.
Oh, yeah, most certainly. You rarely hear people talk about what the Barclays Ag Bond Index did year to date. You know, you always hear it in terms of the yield on the 10-year, but as far as actual performance of it, you don't hear it. So, yeah, it's a great thing. A few weeks ago, Keith Klein, who's on the radio a fair amount and sits in for Glass when Glass has some time off, Keith Klein was in on a Friday morning when I call in, and that was his exact question to me is, hey, the market's doing gangbusters, but I don't feel like my portfolio is doing as well as the rest of the market. And I said, well, Keith, based on the fact that you are semi-retired, he's retired from his full-time gig, right, but he still has lots of other things that he's doing, that you're probably in a balanced portfolio, and half of your portfolio isn't doing what the S&P 500 done. So the S&P 500 or the Dow Jones Industrial or the NASDAQ, that is not your benchmark to see how your portfolio is doing if you own half stocks and half bonds.
Yeah, I just thought I should say that. And Keith asked me the same question in an email, so he must have not understood your answer or mine. I don't know. Sorry, brother. All right, hey, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about what's more important than anything, what's coming up rather than what's behind us, because obviously, you know, the markets move on speculation, then they adjust on reality. So what is the reality as we look into the fourth quarter? We'll be back to talk about that and more. This is Your Money with David Hayes. We shouldn't make fun of poor Keith Klein that way on the air. We should do it behind his back.
I think he was just trying to do a service to all the other listeners out there that wanted to ask the same question but hadn't had the opportunity.
Okay. Brother Keith, no one's like him. He's a good guy. All right, folks, I know that the third quarter is behind us. In fact, the last year is almost behind us, believe it or not, as we enter the fourth quarter. And you know what? As we think about what's on the horizon for the fourth quarter when it comes to the markets, well, I'll tell you this. By most accounts, betting against a strong fourth quarter probably seems like a bad idea. The S&P 500 has grown during the fourth quarter in 7 out of the 8 past years. Americans remain very bullish on the economy, very optimistic, and they continue to increase their spending. And even as their incomes grow, they should spend more. Inflation remains low. It's all expansive. In addition, manufacturing, services, housing all seem to be supporting economic expansion. And the growth, as we were saying in the first segment, the growth's not limited to the United States. I mean, globally, 94% of countries are experiencing year-over-year economic growth. So, of course, in the coming weeks, we're going to get even a closer and clearer understanding of what happened in the third quarter and what our fourth quarter expectations will be. So, obviously, Rod, they're listening to find out what we think, and I just don't see anything changing anytime soon. And I did a there's some people that are maybe going to invite me onto a television station up in Indianapolis at some point to talk about things, and they wanted to know my opinion of something. And I said, well, listen, I mean, when it comes to the market right now, the market moves on speculation. It adjusts on reality. What's happened is it originally moved on speculation of lower taxes, less regulation, but then it was supported by reality of good earnings and supported by all these other things we've talked about already, only to then readjust based on new speculations of, oh, yeah, taxes and deregulation. We get a little glimpse into what may be tax reform. We get a little glimpse into some deregulations, most recently the EPA. So it seems like we're continually moving down this road of speculation, reality underpinning it, speculation, reality underpinning it. So I don't see the fourth quarter really changing much.
No, neither do I. And actually right now, as far as earnings estimates go, the third quarter was the slow growth quarter of this year. The annual earnings per share growth was estimated to grow at around double digits, 10, 11% or so. You had double digit growth in the first and second quarter. It's expected to be single digit here this third quarter. And actually this week, they just started those earnings releases. A couple of the big banks were the first ones out with their earnings. So it's expected. But then the fourth quarter is supposed to ramp right back up and be somewhere in the double digit area in that category. So, no, you know, the thing is, everybody keeps talking about how long this bull market has gone on. The reality is, if you go back and look historically, bull markets don't die of old age. You know, they die because something has happened that changed the underlying dynamics and fundamentals that was causing the bull market. Typically, it's a prelude to a recession. You know, that's why so many people have talked so much about watching the yield curve, because an inverted yield curve has typically happened almost every time right before a recession. So there is some concern of that. And I say concern of that only because it's flat. It's not that people are predicting that it is going to invert. It's just that it's not a steep curve. Therefore, if short rates rise fast enough and long rates don't, then it's so flat you could see that inversion. But other than that, bull markets just don't go away because, oh gosh, they've been around for 7 years, they've been around for 8 years. If you still have good earnings growth, if people are still buying your widgets and you're still able to manufacture and potentially even have to hire to keep up with demand, that continues this little momentum that we've had going. And that doesn't even take into account whether or not our government can get their own act together and fix some of the problems that both sides acknowledge that we have and need fixed. But of course, when they get in the same room and start talking about it, then things change completely and they don't want to do certain things.
You know, the Fed is going to probably raise rates again. And folks, they don't control much when it comes to the rates. Most of the rates are dictated by the capital markets, you know, what people are willing to accept as far as a rate of return. And right now, the 30-year Treasury is under 3%. The 10-year Treasury is around, what, 2.2, 2.3?
Just ticked down to like 2.33 today. Yeah. It had made a run close to 2.4. But, yeah, you're not very high on a 10-year Treasury.
No, so, and then you look at the Fed that can really only manipulate the very, very short end of the curve. And that's where the problem lies. What happens if you have short-term rates that are equal to or greater than long-term rates? Long-term rates are dictating future growth. If there isn't any growth, that's where the recession comes in. I'll tell you right now, Hot Rod, if we go inverted, man, I'm running for the hills, because I've been down this road too many times. And I always talk myself out of it by saying, you know, an inverted curve doesn't always indicate a recession, but it usually does. So what I'm going to say is, if it goes inverted, I'm going to go sit on the sideline for a while, maybe not in 100%. I'm not talking about 100% cash, but just be you know, I mean, if we've been doing this a long time, so
yeah, just reduce the exposure is really our thing. You know, and I find that interesting that you bring that up, because I've thought about having that conversation with Eric Geisler, our fixed income manager, because I have heard a few guys from the fixed income world that have talked about they could see the curve invert and it not be the negative reason that you've always seen in the past that then led to a recession. Now, fixed income isn't my specialty. I live that to Eric Geisler, so I'm not about to debate or argue whether those guys are right, but I feel the same as you. Historically, an inverted curve in the past hasn't been good things for the future of the stock market.
You know, it's gotten so crazy in the bond market that countries that we would have absolutely run away from, you know, as fast as we could go, money's pouring into them. Countries I can't even pronounce their names. Greece is issuing debt and people are gobbling it up. Are you kidding me? Has anything really changed in Greece? That's when the risk appetite, in my opinion, is getting a little over its skis. But here's the thing, guys. You have so much money that needs a place to go. And if the markets are tipping at a high point and we're talking about U.S. domestic yields low, there's a hunger for it. And here's what happens. The immediacy of default on a 10-year bond in some Central American country that I can't even pronounce the name isn't there. So they just issue, let's say, like $50 billion worth of bonds. Are they going to default tomorrow or next year or the next year? Probably not. But are they going to default at some point? Probably. And that's why they're way below junk status, but people are willing to buy it because they're going to get a 7% coupon on a bond. And I think the expectations there are that, hey, we're going to get it while we can, but we're going to get out of it way early before it goes down, let some other sucker write it down. And Rod, there was some research that just came out. We don't have much more time before the next break, but that what's the average investor expect to make on their accounts? I was shocked when I saw this. Now, it was one of these things. We surveyed 1,000 people, and who knows who they
right.
were
who,
or what age.
Who got called in that 1,000?
Yeah. But the expectations going forward, they said, was to earn over 12% per annum. And I look at this and I think, are you freaking kidding me?
Yeah.
Because most people are saying, okay, the equity markets, you know, maybe 5 to 8%, the bond markets, maybe 2%. So if you average those together, if you have a 50-50 portfolio, you know, you're going to be sitting, best case scenario, maybe 5-6%.
Look, that thought process is what has a lot of pension funds in serious trouble.
Yeah.
You know, historically, they calculated their performance based on getting a 12% annualized return. That then backs them into a number of what they need to deposit on an annual basis to cover that future liability that they have. And then lo and behold, they didn't get 12%, so they didn't deposit enough money. They didn't get the growth they needed, and now they're dramatically underfunded.
But
talk to the people in Illinois and Chicago,
yeah,
how they feel about that pension and the likelihood of, while you're retired and no longer wanting to work, getting a pay cut.
They actually used those expectations back in the 90s during the new normal. You remember that? And then they decided after the tech bubble burst, 2001, 2002, 2003, boom, 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 everything went down. We all of a sudden we're now saying, okay, maybe it's not 12. Let's make it 8. And then, you know, it looked okay for a while, but then 2008 hit and everything went to heck in a handbasket. And then most pension funds said, well, rather than reduce what our expectations are, we're going to add more to equities, you know, right in 2007, 2008. So that didn't work out very
yeah,
well.
Increase the risk
right,
of the portfolio.
Right. So now you're starting to see some pensions finally say, okay, we're just going to have to fund this thing right, or we're going to have to lower expectations. And it's not so much in the corporate world, in the public sector, in the private sector. It's more in the public sector,
yeah,
the public pensions, which are just, you know, they're just winging it.
Right. That's the one that I'm referring to in Chicago and Illinois, is it's the public sector and that public pension that is struggling. And yeah, you know, for everybody, even the retail person, not just the pensions, take a reasonable approach of earning 5 to 6%, you know, on your assets in pursuing retirement. And then if you get that 12%, great, good for you. You know what? You're ahead of the ball game. And rather than completely change your dynamics, understand that at some point in the future, you're going to have a negative year.
Right.
So hopefully that positive 12 offsets that negative year, and you can still come in on goal of that 5 or 6% over the long haul.
We're going to take a break, but before I go, I want to say one thing. Brad and I talked about, you know, diversification, and people use that as a risk management strategy. But folks, almost everything's correlated in today's world. And there's a big difference between diversification and correlation. And I think right now we've been focusing more on how do you have non-correlated assets so that if you do have a pullback, if you do have a setback, which it will come at some point, how are you not correlated to that? Because back in 2008, guys, whenever the market tanked, it wasn't just the stock market, it was the bond market, it was gold, it was real estate. The only thing that held up were U.S. treasuries and cash. That was it. They do not have the same correlation as everything else. So when you think about talking with your financial person, looking at your 401k, think about correlation rather than diversification. There's a big, big difference. And unfortunately, in a lot of these vehicles or a lot of your investment accounts, there's not many places that you can go to find non-correlated assets. But they're out there. You just have to be educated about them, and that's probably the time for a different show or something that we should talk about during another show. All right, we're going to take a break. There was a Nobel Prize in economics. Goes to Doug Hughes. No, not really. He wishes that it would go to him and the $1 million that came along with it. But it came on the heels of what I've been talking about for years, investor behavior. You know, economists think that people act the way that they would act or as a prudent person should act. But they don't act that way, especially when it comes to money. Remember, the most emotional things that people deal with are family and money. And we don't act rational in our family, Hot Rod,
no,
for sure. And we certainly don't act rational when it comes to money. So we're going to talk about this Nobel Prize. It was given to a gentleman, and we're going to talk about him. We're going to talk about the study, and Doug Hughes is going to join us to discuss it. Well, this is Your Money with David Hayes. Welcome back, everyone. Your Money with David Hayes. Okay, last weekend we were on fall break, and I don't remember if I announced this on the show or not, but we were going to go out of town. Yeah, I think I talked about that. We were headed to Clearwater, Florida. Very easy trip. Southwest down, southwest back, a little bit of beach time. Checking the weather on that Thursday morning, I think I did talk about this, it looked to be pretty rotten. The whole state was covered in rain. There was a potential hurricane coming up through the Gulf, and on a dime, I said, hey, why don't we pivot and go out west? So keep in mind, we were leaving the very next day. So I get back to the office, and Angela in my office is also a magical Disney planner, so if any of you need a Disney trip plan, she may be the very best. In fact, that's where she's at this week and left me high and dry, as I've had many, many voicemails, many emails, all the things. You never know how much someone does for you until they're gone. I remember when my wife went on a girls' trip for like 4 days. It was terrible. It was absolutely terrible. I didn't realize how much stacked up in the sink, how many dirty clothes we accumulate. When you have a 16-year-old son, I don't know, Rob, if it's changed at your household, but somehow, some way, they go through like 6 outfits a day.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
It just piles up in the floor, and anyway, it doesn't make any sense. So she's gone now, but anyway, she planned us a trip to Disneyland in Anaheim. So boom, great. We changed plans. We're headed to Atlanta, go down to Anaheim, have a great, great trip. The last day, there were fires that broke out in Anaheim Mountains or Anaheim Hills, and the whole area of Disneyland was covered in like a yellow smoke, and we had asphalt and almost everything else. And of course, down in the valleys or in Northern California, in wine country, of course, you saw the devastation there. It was unbelievable. My older brother Dan happened to be there on his, I think, 25th wedding anniversary. They came back a day early because of the fire. So it was a great trip. Kind of ended rough with the smoke, but even worse, my plane was only 10 minutes late getting out of the John Wayne Airport, and we landed in Minneapolis to make a connection, which, by the way, if you've ever been in the Minneapolis Airport, it's like a big horseshoe, and you don't want to be at the end of the horseshoe and have to make it all the way around to the other end. It takes about 45 minutes. So we get to our gate, and we're on a hump. My wife and I, as fast as she could run, and she had to go to the bathroom, so it was just crazy. So we get there. 10 minutes before the flight takes off, they said, we just gave up your seat. You got to be kidding me. So it gave me an opportunity to show my son, as an example, how you act in adverse situations. And fortunately, I didn't have to say much because there was a guy from the East Coast, and you know how people from the East Coast can get a little bit belligerent, a little bit quickly. I mean, he lights into this lady. I mean, ripped her upside down the other, and I'm just standing there, you know, being very calm and polite. And at the end, you know, I told my son, I said, hey, here's the deal. I said, there people are going to want to help you more when you are nice to them, not belligerent like that guy. So, in fact, that guy was getting so belligerent, I just wanted to, like, take my shoe and knock him in the head because it was so bad. But anyway, so we ended up being delayed. We got out of there, I don't know, 10 o'clock at night, got into Indianapolis. I finally laid down in bed about 2:30 in the morning. So it was a rough Wednesday morning getting back into the office and, of course, giving Glass a call at 7:20. Hopefully I sounded somewhat coherent when I did that. But it was a rough start. But here's the thing. The guy that griped so much, He got on another flight to Detroit to connect in Indianapolis, and he was going to get in like at 8 o'clock at night, okay, versus midnight like me. So I'm like thinking to myself, okay, the guy that squeaky wheel got the grease on this one. Well, just out of curiosity, about 8 o'clock that night, we were having some dinner there at the airport, and I thought, I'm going to check that flight. Well, that flight got grounded in Detroit, and he never got out. So there you go, folks. If you act like a jerk, then it's going to come back around to get you. So as we talk about behavioral finance, I think behavior in general is a good thing to discuss. But I think I set a pretty good example on how to handle an adverse situation. We got home safely, and everything was cool. Here's the thing. A guy named Richard Thaler, he won the Nobel Prize in Economics. He says when it comes to investing in stocks, saving for retirement, making daily financial decisions, people's emotions, biases, lack of self-control end up hurting their bottom line. No big surprise. He says the not-so-rational money moves that people make have basically sprouted this field called behavioral economics or behavioral finance. So on Monday, this field burst into the public eye when Richard Thaler won the Nobel Prize. They call him the father of behavioral economics. He won, the 2017 Nobel Prize in like $1.1 million or $1.2 million in cash. He also made a cameo appearance in the 2015 movie The Big Short. If you've seen that, it's pretty cool. But he talks about how people's financial misbehavior in things ranging from household finances to TV game shows. I've been watching some of that lately, and people do make irrational decisions. I saw a lady on Jeopardy. There was a Wheel of Fortune the other night, and she said, I came here to gamble. I'm all in. And she pushed all of her chips in. She ended up winning, which was kind of cool. But he talked about it's about the way people actually behave as opposed to the way economists think people behave. He says economists believe that people are highly rational, unemotional creatures. He said the people I study are humans that are closer to Homer Simpson than anything else. He said, we as humans don't choose the right things. That's a big surprise to anybody. Sometimes we overeat. We don't exercise enough. We don't save enough. We make bad decisions with money. It happens all the time. And he breaks this down into a couple of different areas. And one hot rod is called the hot hand fallacy. He talks about how a gambler sits at a blackjack table, wins a ton of hands in a row, and thinks his luck will not run out. It'll continue. Or like a stock investor who bought into the NASDAQ back in 1999, put 10 grand in, it ran up to 18,000, thought it was going to continue to happen, only to see 2001, 2, and 3 come around and wash it all away. So we have this hot hand fallacy that I think people buy into pretty easily. I think it's easy to buy into it. I mean, we're seeing that maybe even with Bitcoin right now. Who knows?
Yeah, most certainly. Well, the interesting thing with that, and when you look at the behavioral finance, and as you alluded to, economics is a social science that is based on people making rational decisions. Now, part of that is because in economics, and when they're building models, they like to strip out other variables because it becomes very complicated to model something that potentially has 8, 10, 12, 15 different variables. So they really strip it down to the bare bones minimum to look at how this one thing affects the other. But of course, in the real world, that's not how it works. All of those variables are in play, the same as while some people may make rational decisions with their money, there are far many more who don't make rational decisions with their money. I mean, the two biggest emotions that are so hard to control when it comes to money decisions, it's fear and greed.
Right.
And typically, those emotions are what dictate decisions that people make.
The other thing he talks about is the endowment effect, which I thought was pretty interesting. He says this mental miscue is when people place a greater value on things they own than the things they don't own. I see that with real estate all the time. I see that with personal possessions. I mean, my father-in-law passed away in May, and we're kind of going through, you know, they're going through his stuff. I haven't done a lot of the work. My wife and brother-in-law and sister-in-law have done most of it. But my good friend Dirk Bland, the auctioneer, comes over and he looks around and, you know, things like, I'm like, this old STP oil can that's never been opened. He's like, oh, yeah, keep that. It's worth like $25. Okay, cool. But other things you think, well, this might be worth something. He goes, can't even take it. In fact, you know, television sets, if they have a tube in them like the old ones, he said, they're worth about 50 cents. And I go, really that much? He said, no, I'm just gave you 50 cents just to make you feel good. But again, there's so many things you look at and think, well, that's a 1950 cool-looking TV with a neat-looking cabinet. Surely somebody would take that, and maybe they would, but they're not going to pay you for it. But a lot of people have this endowment effect is what he calls it, which makes people think the things they own are worth more than what they really are.
Yeah, on the TV side, I think you have to go way, way, way back when they were built in the big wooden boxes. Now, I have seen some pretty cool things in which people have taken those and utilized them to make retro furniture out of it. But as far as an old TV per se, no, it isn't any good unless it's one of those big units that's wrapped in wood and you turn that into some sort of new retro furniture that you set as an end table, a coffee table. Then maybe you have something. But other than that, they're not worth anything. And the landfills don't even want them.
They won't even take them. You got to pay money to get rid of them. The last thing that he talks about, Thaler, in the Nobel Prize winning research about mental accounting, he says that economists think that we as humans think of every dollar the same. And he says that his research challenged that notion in that every dollar is the same in every person's mind. His work shows that people do a mental accounting in their heads. So in other words, you know, and you see this. I mean, people, I mean, heck, I won't go to McDonald's unless I have a buy one, get one free coupon for my Egg McMuffin, which is like $3, right? But I might spend a ton of money on something like two anchors for my bass boat that I only use six times a year. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. So again, people take value the dollars spent here versus dollars spent there. So dollars spent on vacations or dollars spent on paying bills or recreation or saving for retirement, you know, it's all different. Like, I get a lot more pleasure out of the money that I spent in Anaheim than I did the money I put in my Roth IRA. So there's just a difference there, Hot Rod, in how people view money.
Yeah, most certainly. My son and I have been having a lot of talks here recently about investments and Bitcoin and stocks and things like that. And the other day he came home and goes, yeah, wow, Bitcoin, it's been on fire, but it dropped $20. That's a lot. And I'm like, well, no, it isn't. And he goes, yeah, $20. I said, well, wait, let's look at this from your perspective. 20 is a lot. But I said, you're talking about a $4,800 price that went down $20. You have to evaluate it in percent. Percentage. Because I said, that's not a very big drop versus look at it as a you invested in something that costs $30 and it drops $20. Well, you're almost wiped out of your investment in that scenario. So to you, 20 is a lot of money because you're a poor college kid and 20 goes a long, long ways for you. But 20 for many other people isn't a lot of money. So that $20 loss for someone who maybe put $4,800 in Bitcoin wasn't a big deal to them like he was thinking.
We're having the same discussions at my house, but it's about real estate investing. So we'll keep you apprised of how this is going to go. All right, got to take a quick break. When we come back, Josh Norris from our office, the Medicare guru, is going to be calling, talking about open enrollment, who needs to pay attention, who does not. We'll be right back. This is Your Money with David Hayes. Welcome back, everyone. Your Money with David Hayes. Thanks so much for hanging out with us. It's been the Investment Show. We got Josh Norris now on the line. We're switching gears. Josh, of course, is our Medicare guru at our office, CFC. So if you need any help or information about this open enrollment period that's coming up very, very soon, give us a shout or shoot us an email at cfci.us and we'll connect you with Brother Josh. Josh, hey, let's talk about what's coming up. And last week you had to correct me. I kept saying the Medicare open enrollment period starting very, very soon. I think you had to correct me on the actual open enrollment period, what it is and who it involves and who needs to pay attention and who doesn't.
Yeah, so Medicare enrollment coming up for 2018. It begins October 15th and will end December 7th. So that's the time that if people want to make a change to their advantage plan or they want to make a change to their threat plan, now's the time to do it and make it effective for 2018. And also, if you wanted to change your Medicare supplement, you can get a better rate. You can definitely do it in this time period as well.
Awesome, Josh. So if they want to get a hold of you, just have them email you over at CFCI. Medicare.us, and we'll make sure they get on the right path. So, Josh, thanks for taking the time. Hey, and also, congratulations on an interview you're going to have tomorrow with CNBC.com. Sarah O'Brien is going to be interviewing you at 4 o'clock tomorrow on some Medicare questions. So, congratulations. That's a big first step for you getting into the national media.
Yeah, I'm excited about that. Hopefully, I'll be ready. I think I will.
Yeah, you'll be fine. You'll be fine. Hey, thanks a lot, man. I'll be talking to you soon.
All right.
Bye. Well, guys, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll wrap up the big show. This is Your Money with David Hayes. Welcome back, everyone. Your Money with David Hayes. Just a couple minutes left in the program. It has been the investment show. Rod Holloway's been in the house the entire time. We're going to have Doug Hughes call in. That didn't work out. Then we had Josh Norris call in. That did work out, but we were getting a little feedback from somewhere, somehow, some way, which made it a little bit hard to hear. So we cut that off just a little bit short. But again, open enrollment period's coming up. If you're of Medicare age and you're just confused, you don't know what to do, you're going to really, really like getting to know Josh. He's a great guy, knows a lot about this stuff. And you can, again, get a hold of him over at our office, cfci.us. All right, if you missed any of the show, you can catch it on Saturday morning, 9 a.m., right before IU kicks off. I already have basketball season on my mind. I'm a football guy. Kick off against the Wolverines and Hot Rod. I saw that the line right now is only Michigan +7. I mean, -7. So there's a small favorite, not a big favorite.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. I mean, it's two teams that so far have been dominated by their defenses, and both offenses have struggled a little bit. So which offense can step up this weekend will probably be the one that walks away with the W.
Well, wouldn't that be great to beat Michigan at home on homecoming? I can't wait. I'll be out there noon start. And then, hey, if you're looking for something fun to do, my son is was junior at Bloomington South this year. And, yeah, we've heard me talk about his wrestling and all that during that part of the season. But he's also in the Sounds of South group. And they have their performance, Hello Dolly, that starts this Saturday. And they're going to be performing this Saturday at the Carmichael Center there at the high school. You can buy tickets at the door. You can go to online or Bus Kirk Chumley, I think, selling them as well. And then the next two Saturdays in a row, so like the 21st and whatever the next Saturday would be, 7 days later, 28th. So if you're looking for something really, really fun, inexpensive, and you'll be amazed that these are high school kids doing the performance, go check it out. I'll be there Saturday. This Saturday, I'll be there on the 21st. I will be there on the 28th. That's what parents do, right? Hot Rod, you would be there all three performances. You watched your daughter cheer, and you watched a lot of baseball.
I spent many 8 to 12-hour days in convention centers to watch my daughter perform a 3-minute cheer routine.
All right, Hot Rod, appreciate you being here. Next week, we're going to be talking about a lot of great things. I've got a lot of stuff to cover next week, so we'll make sure we bring an outstanding show. In a couple weeks, I'll be at a conference, but I will be back to do the show on that Thursday night. So, again, man, the year's gone by fast. I can't believe it. Hey, we're going to take a long break, like a one-week break, and we'll see you next week. Bye-bye. The preceding program was brought to you by Comprehensive Financial Consultants and CFCI, which is solely responsible for its content. Securities are offered through J.W. Cole Financial, member FINRA and SIPC. Investment advice offered through CFCI and J.W. Cole Advisors. J.W. Cole Financial, J.W. Cole Advisors, and CFCI are unaffiliated entities.